You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Hello friends, welcome to SCM Young Voices. To start off, I'd just like to give a shout out to the Methodist Church. Thank you for allowing us to do this and for hosting and for making sure we don't go wet by putting that back up again. So thank you very much. So SCM is a progressive student-led movement of student Christians exploring faith and importantly how we put faith into action. So one of the ways we do that is supporting young theologians, which is what we're doing today. So you're going to hear from six young theologians. The layout of the session is we'll hear from the first three. They'll do short 10-minute talks on a range of themes, and then you'll have a 15-minute break to reflect, go and grab refreshments if you need, and have chats about what you've just heard. After that 15-minute break, we'll hear from the final three. Does that sound okay? Good, because that's what we're doing. Lovely. To kick us off, we have Niamh, who will be talking discipleship across the generations. Welcome, Niamh.
Okay, great. My voice is a bit hoarse from the glitter ball last night, so apologies. When I was in school, a teacher told me that I was very, very good at asking good questions, but that I don't necessarily give clear answers. So it was a very fair judgment, so prepare yourself for a lot of questions in this, and maybe we'll find some answers along the way. The title of my talk is Discipleship Across the Generations, so it's probably a good idea to get a bit of a clue what I'm talking about when I say discipleship. The word disciple comes from the Latin for learner, and it's used probably by us in a very Christian context, but other frameworks can have quite a discipling model. To be a disciple of someone is to learn from and in some ways to imitate them. Think what it would look like to be a disciple of Taylor Swift, of Elon Musk, or of Tommy Robinson. To look at discipleship is to look at what it means to be a learner. So in an age that has been called the time of culture wars, who are we learning from? And what are we learning about? For those of us who are interested spiritually or academically in liberation theology, what does it mean when we decide to look at discipleship? I'm going to borrow from some of the SCM resources here to give you a bit of an overview of liberation theology. Liberation theology has grown out of political and economic conditions that are very different to the Britain that we know today. But it's something that really intrigues so many churchgoers and academics. It emerged in the late 1960s, primarily in Latin American Catholicism, focusing on the liberation of oppressed peoples, emphasizing the role of the church in addressing inequality, poverty, and human rights. The wider movement is rooted in the belief that Christian faith and teachings should be actively applied to fight against any oppression. Hopefully today, I will persuade you that if we are to seek liberation theologies within our British context, intergenerational community must be at the heart of our pursuit. Let's begin by looking at an example of intergenerational community in practice in a liberation theology. So this is from an Eritrean perspective. There is a book called African Liberation Theology, Intergenerational Conversations on Eritrea's Future. And in it, the authors discuss how the history of post-colonial Africa isn't static and it isn't uniform, but what can be done is conversations can happen to develop a national identity. And they claim that African unique and Eritrean unique identity is the thing, is the elixir that binds the multicultural, multilingual, and multi-religious society together. The book ultimately provides a very hopeful outlook that through connection across a wide age range, Eritrea can be the country that Eritreans dreamed about. A country that can embrace its cultures, its traditions, its religions, its ethnicities, its tribes, and its regions. So discussions of national identity is kind of an unlikely meeting point for brilliant things to happen in this case. And we could do what we kind of tend to do with a lot of British theologies, which is just go, okay, I'll take that. We'll do that. it could be tempting to just borrow from it as the complete solution to our problem. But to do that wouldn't address the history of colonization and oppression that is very different in our context. Some would say that a British liberation theology itself simply isn't possible, because what even is Britishness, and what does it need to be liberated from? This is why for liberation theologies to serve as a tool in our context, they have to be decolonized. Whilst liberation theologies undertake their work from the position of the undervalued and the marginalized in society, traditional British theologies are from an opposite angle. They're from the things that are set in culture. They're from a dominant culture. And that dominant culture is now coming to terms with processes of decolonization and also increasing secularization. Before liberation theology's inception, theological propositions were assumed to be universal. But the Western Church is now learning that theology has to have context. Theology is contextually dependent. In liberation theology, they emphasize the need for orthopraxy over orthodoxy. So that's right practice over right belief. If we're striving to adopt liberation theologies into our context, that means that right practice has to be at the heart of what we do. In the case of Eritrea, right practice looked like opening up conversations about national identity. And we've seen national identity be used as a conversation starter a lot in the UK too. And it's specifically used and targeted at young people quite recently. So in the Conservative Party's recent campaign, Rishi Sunak brought up a proposal for a national service scheme, which, I mean, I have many thoughts on, but I found it really interesting that when discussing why they needed this scheme, why now, the rhetoric that was being used by a lot of its proponents was constantly talking as if young people don't have a sense of duty. I think we all know that that isn't true. But what is interesting is they focused on the idea that this would strengthen national identity. This would strengthen what Britain is. All schools are currently required to teach British values. So it's happening in education too. The British values that schools are required to teach are the values of democracy, rule of law, individual liberty, and mutual respect and tolerance of those with different faiths and beliefs. Ofsted inspectors actually have to judge a school by how well it teaches those British values. And it's also seen as, so like, they are saying theoretically that there is a distinct Britishness. Where they get that Britishness from is quite interesting. A key component of PREVENT, the counterterrorism strategy, is this idea of a distinct and a teachable Britishness, which there's an interesting book by Martin Thomas where he breaks down PREVENT as a triangle of power, and he looks at the, he says the main reason that PREVENT doesn't work is because it demonstrates the urge to define and dictate a concise Britishness. It's just highly problematic in practice. So if we're thinking of applying liberation theologies to our situations and Britishness isn't really a tool for liberation, I think that the solution could lie in formation of authentic personal connections within communities. And places of worship are perhaps some of the most intergenerational, I should say that word, I'm saying it a million times, intergenerational places in Britain today, just by their nature. By bringing together different generations, churches can create spaces where wisdom, traditions, and spiritual experiences can be shared, and it enriches the lives of all the members. These connections don't just strengthen people's individual faith, but they build a more resilient and a more inclusive community. Faith-based spaces aren't the only places to be doing this, but we have to recognize that there is something innate that's already there that we can build upon. So how does intergenerational community further liberation? Age is a dividing line. It's a protected characteristic. And it's a dividing line that reinforces power dynamics, with younger or older people often marginalized and undervalued. Connection across age groups is a practice of liberation because it dismantles the societal barriers that often segregate people based on age. Authentic connections break stereotypes. They build spaces where wisdom, creativity, energy, and support for one another, just like we have here today, are exchanged freely and people can speak freely. As members of communities, we must frequently ask ourselves, whose voices and whose stories are we not hearing? Stories are a brilliant way for connection to happen. And intergenerational storytelling threatens the ideology of the good old days. To tell a story that is unafraid of discussing the lived realities of poverty and injustice through different decades is to rebel against this narrative of the good old days, which is used to romanticize oppression. It is so good for us to regularly assess who we are listening to and what we're learning about in every context that we're in. I think it is our call as disciples. It is our duty, and it is our national service to do so. To resist the divisions that are sown between the generations in pursuit of education and collaboration. So I'm going to leave you with a question for you to think about when we come to our break, which is, what would a promotion of discipleship across generations look like within your own context? Thank you.
Thank you, Niamh. We have our next speaker up. Would you please welcome Rue, who is talking the soul, sexuality, and gender identities.
Hi, I'm Rue Davis. SCM has very kindly brought me up here today. I really love SCM. As we were announced, SCM is a progressive Christian group, and I really want to focus on what both of those words mean, progressive and Christian, and the importance of having both of them together. What is really, really great about SCM is the way that they keep Christianity central to progress. And I think if we want good progress, we need to keep Christ at the center of that. Without Christ, we end up in this position where we ask, what are we progressing to? We need ends to progress towards. Having progress grounded in good values found in the Bible, found in God, is what's so essential if we want to have good progress. Without Christian progressivism, we end up with progress towards what? Towards a vapid humanism, possibly, whatever makes you happy, whatever feels good, whatever's gratifying. And we also end up with what Jacques Ellul, this French theologian, calls technique, which is roughly this idea that efficiency is the be-all and end-all now, for the sake of efficiency. And he says, this has really started since the Industrial Revolution, that humanity has been brought in as cogs into this machine, working towards something other than human ends, towards productivity. And if we look at it, we are all working towards that already, just towards efficiency. Metrics for what progress means, for what good means, is how much is the economy growing by, how much have we increased GDP, all of these things. And we're not really working towards human ends, but rather efficient ends. And this is only going to get worse, probably within our lifetimes, because Norbert Wiener, a computer scientist back in the 1950s, predicted that within this next century, we're going to undergo a second industrial revolution, where in the first industrial revolution, human labor was surpassed by machinery, and the human physical labor was made obsolete. Now human mental labor is going to be made obsolete as artificial intelligence progresses. And the worry is then, what's left for the human? Where is the human? Why do we value the human if all we value is efficiency? What is left for the human? And I think that's why we need Christian progressivism, where Christianity focuses on the human, it focuses on the spirit, and the spirit is at the center of all we do and all that is important, because the human is God's most beloved. We are all created in God's image, and we have the spirit within us, and we need to see one another as bearers of that spirit. And that's the only way that we can center progressivism to push towards good ends, which really value humanity, value creation, value God's gift to us. I want to refer to quite an unknown verse in Genesis, Genesis 1:26. This is a verse in which God talks about dominion being given to man over all of the earth. And I think there's a very boring, straightforward reading of this where, oh, it's just saying man has dominion over the earth. And I think we need to dig deeper and look at what is really being said here, that dominion is given to man, meaning all humanity here, rather than this efficiency, rather than projections of efficiency, projections of outcomes, that we were meant to be here on this earth and do things on this earth for our fellow man, for one another, for God's glory, for the glory of one another, as God is found in us, not for these machines. He gave dominion to us, not to machines, not to efficiency, not to projections. I promise I am getting around to sexuality and gender. And so this makes us think about what Christian progress is like, what it should be. And it's human-focused, it's anthropocentric. It doesn't need to be strictly anthropocentric. Animals, all of the creatures, nature is a wonderful part of God's creation, and all of these things we need to keep central. And we should look at this as it applies to gender and sexuality. So when we consider what an anthropocentrism looks like when it comes to gender, it means privileging the unique and varied experiences of gender over cold and rigid systems that roughly map out kind of averages, studies, and all of these things. Only through looking at the unique experiences, taking them seriously, understanding that God has a unique plan for everybody, that each of their experiences is divinely mapped out, and taking them seriously, not dismissing them as, oh, this is just a sinful twisting, this is a product of the fall, as is often done in these quite conservative evangelical spaces, but understanding God has possibly set this person out on this path to have this identity, no matter how unique it is, no matter how disjunct it is from our typical and like scientific conceptions of this. And in this way, we can see that a Christian progressivism loves and embraces a person and puts a person at the center of that progress and of that acceptance. And when it comes to loving others as well, we need a similar approach where we need to open and expand ideas of love from strict heterosexuality. And I think the reasons for having a strictly heterosexual view are varied. Not particularly good in any case. I think it ranges from, oh, they just make me feel icky, all the way to, I've been put onto bad secondary sources by my church. And I think a lot of people are unfortunate and unlucky to have had that happen to them. But I think we need to be mindful of what a good expansion of sexuality looks like, a good expansion of inclusive sexuality looks like. It's a sexuality which includes and sees people as fully human, fully embodying the spirit. It's one where love isn't this product. It's not something that can be algorithmically determined by Tinder, by whatever dating site you want. Love is this very unique gift which we get to experience as Christians, which we see and feel and which we share all the time. And that love isn't this convenient thing. It's not seeing one another as products. It's not any of this. It's seeing one another as spirit bearers rather than resources. And you can see how this applies to this technique, to industrialization, where we don't want to see one another as these tools, as these things that are convenient, as these things that gratify one another, but as fully embodied people, people who bear the spirit. It got me thinking, I don't know if any of you were listening to the AI talk this morning, but Father Justin was this sort of AI preacher set up by this Catholic organization in California. And it's bewildering, really, that we have an AI father, this AI that has not experienced the spirit, will never experience the spirit, can never experience the spirit. And they're more open to that than they are to homosexual people in clergy. You know, that the Catholic Church is more happy and more readily accepting of this machine than it is of people who have that experience of the Spirit. And I think we need to focus on that love that is so central to Christian progress. When you think of progress, what is motivating it? It's that love, it's that experience, it's the Spirit. And I think finally, I just want to give an example of what bad liberation can look like. I think if we think of the liberation of the body, this has very often been something that has been a very progressive issue and has often been absent of a Christian perspective. I think often it's been this step of progress away from a repressive, conservative Christian ethic of modesty into this new liberation. But we should be skeptical of what this liberation has brought. And the reasons why this liberation has brought so many negative consequences is because it's not been focused on the Spirit. It's not been focused on understanding people as bearers of the Spirit. It's been focused on a simple liberation. And so we have this liberation now. The body is used everywhere in marketing materials. It's in the workplace. It's open for consumption. You can readily put your body out for consumption in various forms. And there's a lot of freedom that comes with that, and there's a lot of gratification that comes with that, with having liberty and control over your body and with consuming other bodies. There is gratification, and on the face of it, especially for a humanist lens, very good things that come from that. But then look at the downsides that have come with that liberation. Now we are alienated from our own bodies. Our bodies become these things to be invested in. It's a whole new sphere that's opened up to marketing. Now we have this whole new range of like hygiene products that need to be considered, need to be brought, need to be purchased, of aesthetics, of aesthetic procedures. We're alienated from our body in a way where now we are something to invest in. You need to buy your health foods. You need to eat healthy. You need to be on this diet. You need to work out. You need to have your gym membership. And in a real sense, we're qualitatively no more liberated. It's just a different type of repression that we've got into now. And yet it gratifies us. And so it's harder to identify. Where it was easy to identify, I'm not free while I'm being repressed, while I'm being forced to cover up, to be modest. It's much harder to recognize I'm not free when it feels pretty good in my own freedom. And we see this is a very common theme where the adversary, Satan, tempts us. Things that feel really good often bring us into less and less freedom. And so I just want to finish with a question for you here. I want to ask you, what would a really worthwhile progressive future look like? If you look to the rest of Generation Z's lives, to your children's lives, to the rest of your lives, what is the progress you would like to see, and is God at the center of it? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rue. We are now going to hand over to the last person in this section before your little break. So I'm passing over to Lou, who will be talking about why I won't give up hope in the church. Welcome, Lou, everybody.
Hello. I think I'm going to sit, if that's all right. So, hello, everyone. I'm very excited to be here. I'm just going to find my notes because they've disappeared. Here we go. Okay, I'll do a little introduction. My name is Lou, as we've established. I live in York with my wife, Grace, who is somewhere at the back there. I have been involved with SCM since 2017. So I started a group with my friend, and I've been a trustee for SCM for about 4 years. So I'm a big SCM fan. When I heard we were introduced as Gen Z, I was slightly unsure if I fit into that because I am wearing skinny jeans, which apparently makes me a millennial, but I'm also reading my notes off my phone, so I don't know. So as you've heard, I'm going to talk a little bit about why I still have hope in the church. I'm going to start off with a bit of a personal story and then broaden out a little bit. I'm going to start off with two disclaimers. When I say church, so the fact I have hope in the church, I don't mean the Church of England, the Methodist Church, any kind of institutional label, any denomination that we might call ourselves. What I'm talking about is kind of organized religion, well, sometimes organized, sometimes not quite so organized, religion, the whole body of Christ where two or three are gathered, etc. I also want to recognize that for some people, the church is not a good place for them to be. And the church has done a lot of harm for people, and it's better for them to not engage with it, and that's okay too. But I'm here to talk about why I still turn up on a Sunday morning. So, I'll start off with a little story. So, when I was 18, I was fresh at uni. I wanted to find a church that I could go to where I could be completely out, I could be myself. I didn't want to go anywhere that was sort of super conservative or where I couldn't be myself or where I'd find out 3 months after being there that I wasn't actually allowed to be on the worship team or something. So I found, surprisingly, a Vineyard church where I was made very welcome. I can hear beer and hymns have started, so I will not be offended if anyone wants to like sneak out. It's all good. So yeah, I ended up at this Vineyard church, and if you know anything about Vineyard sort of nationally, they kind of tend towards the more conservative end of things, I would say. I don't want to generalize, that was my impression. I ended up at a Vineyard church because they seem like great people. I was asked by the pastor if I would grab coffee with him. And if there are any other queer people here, which I'm sure there are, you will know that being asked to grab a coffee by your priest, by your pastor, by some kind of church leadership person is terrifying, because you assume they're going to sit you down and offer to pray for you. They're going to make you change your mind. I mean, it's happened to me. Someone has asked me to, I've gone around for a cup of tea. He didn't even give me a cup of tea, actually. I went around for a cup of tea and he offered to help me change my mind, which was rubbish. But I went out for this coffee with my uni pastor and I was really scared. I was 18, I was in a new city, and he said, how can we make this church a safe place for you? And he said, if anyone says anything negative to you, it wasn't quite let me know and I'll beat him up because he was a pastor, but it was kind of let me know and I'll have a word. So he made me feel really welcomed, really kind of included and really valued. That gave me hope in that particular church. What I want to talk about a little bit is how it's not the people that give me hope. It's not the fact that he was saying, I'm being so gracious that you are welcome here in my church, but good luck anywhere else. It was the fact that he was telling me what I knew to be true, that I had a place there anyway. I think there's a really good quote that I've got from Nadia Boltz-Weber, who has also been a Green Belter. She said, we just look at the seemingly limited space under the tent and think it's our job to change people so that they fit. I'm gonna start this again. We think it's our job to change people so they fit, or it's our job to extend the roof so that they fit. Either way, it's misguided, because it's not our tent, it's God's tent. The wideness of the tent of the Lord should only concern me insofar as it points to the gracious nature of a loving God who became flesh and entered into our humanity. The wideness of the tent should only concern me insofar as it points to the great mercy and love of a God who welcomes us all as friends. So I think, in summary, that gives me hope, because it's not the people that are doing the including. It's not the people that give me hope, in honesty. It's the people that point me to God that give me hope, that I think church has a future. It shows me that God is in control and that we don't have to rely on what people say or what people do, that it's kind of not really to do with us. God doesn't want us to be perfect, but God wants us to show up. We've got a long line of imperfect people in the Bible to follow. I think most of the New Testament is Paul telling people to stop doing weird things. And he wasn't perfect either. I think it's an interesting summary of the New Testament. Just don't do weird things. So we've got things wrong in the past. Historically, we've always been getting things wrong. You look at the news now, we continue to get things wrong, and we will get things wrong in the future. And I can't say that we will always be perfect, because we won't. But Paul isn't saying it's not worth it, give up, because you keep getting things wrong. He's saying, thank you for showing up. You are getting things wrong, so maybe try a bit harder to not do the weird things, but keep showing up. So I will keep showing up. I will keep getting things wrong, but I will still be there on a Sunday morning, because God is. I'm going to end with a quote from C.S. Lewis, who is also another imperfect person, but I think had some good things to say. He said, "The church is not a human society of people united by their natural affinities, but the body of Christ, in which all members, however different, must share the common life, complementing and helping one another precisely by their differences." So my question for you to think about is, what gives you hope? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lou. So at the end of each of those talks, you've been posed a question. You now have about 10 or 15 minutes to reflect on those questions, talk to your other friends. Thank you very much. We've got three more young theologians who will be sharing talks with you all. So the first one, well, the fourth one, but the first one of the second part, is Jem, who will be talking building community with queerness and monasticism. Thank you for that. Monasticism. Welcome, Jem.
So hi, I'm Jem. I'm non-binary. I use they, them pronouns. And I've been exploring a sense of calling to monastic life in the Church of England for over 5 years now. As you might be able to imagine, being non-binary and wanting to be a monk is a pretty unique experience, and therefore a challenging one. But it's also a really rich crossover. And over the years, as I've held these two things together, I've learned loads about the queerness of monasticism, past and present. So in the next 10 minutes, I'm going to explore a bit of how that niche intersection of queerness and monastic life can help all of us build and strengthen the various communities that we're all part of. Queerness and monasticism have gone together for way longer than the modern concept of sexual orientation has even existed. If you lived in, say, the 1100s and you really liked spending time with other people of the same gender and you weren't really bothered about getting married, then entering a monastery or convent was a pretty solid life choice. But even now, where there are literally countless other options for queer people, by all accounts, many people in monastic life are queer. A queer monk I once interviewed suggested marginality as the reason for this lingering correlation. The queer community has been and still is a marginalised community, and monastic communities intentionally exist at the margins of society, withdrawing out to the edges to inhabit an alternative way of life. And so, conceptually at least, queerness and monasticism fit very richly together. But that doesn't mean, by any stretch of the imagination, that queer monks and nuns have always been able to thrive. So I'm going to talk to you about two historical examples of monks who, from our modern perspectives, we can recognise as queer, Marinos and Elred of Rivo, and we'll see how their experiences of community can inform ours. So Marinos probably lived in the 5th century, venerated as a saint by Catholic and Orthodox churches, was assigned female at birth, but then at some point in their life, their mum had died, and so their dad was entering a monastery, and they were like, take me with you. So they shaved their head, put on men's clothes, and went and entered the monastery with their dad. The community just assumed they were a eunuch, and they became a monk. Apparently, it's that easy. One day, Marinos was sent out on an errand with a few other monks and they had to stay at an inn. A few months later, it was discovered that the innkeeper's daughter was pregnant and she said that the father was Marinos. Instead of coming out and proving it was impossible that they were the father, Marinos just asked for forgiveness for this thing they clearly didn't do. And so they were cast out of the monastery for it. They spent many years living just outside the monastery gates, raising this child, until eventually the other monks convinced the abbot to let them back in, but they still had to do all the hardest jobs and they continued to be punished. Eventually, when Marinos died and their body was being prepared for burial, the community realised that they'd been assigned female at birth, and they wept for having punished Marinos wrongly. This is pretty trans, with all the usual historical caveats, but like, Marinos could have just entered a convent, or they could have come out to prove themselves innocent and save themselves from years of suffering, but they didn't. They were steadfast both to their life as a man and to their monastic vows. They didn't seem to do anything to convince the community to let them back in. They didn't even fight or to prove that they were innocent. They just kept on as they were. And when the community that had excluded them finally realised that they were innocent, they realised how unrelentingly faithful Marinos had been. I think Marinos' story can resonate with many experiences of exclusion from a community, but it particularly reminds me of the place of queer people in the church. Often we have to fight, and many good things have come about because of the people who fight. But sometimes we can just carry on as we are, being unrelentingly faithful and unrelentingly queer. Whether we're shut out or allowed in with unfair conditions, we can aspire to Marinos' level of ridiculous perseverance. And some people will eventually recognise our queer faithfulness, and some people won't. But we don't have to convince everyone. We're allowed to just get on with loving God and loving God's people. Community is never an easy thing, and communities can and do cause harm. Marinos suffered unjustly for almost all their time in monastic community, and I'm not saying we should accept the same in our communities. But when Marinos' community finally realised they were wrong, they saw that Marinos had spent their life getting on with the ordinary, everyday task of what we can recognise as queer holiness. Community will always be imperfect, so what might we be able to do if we embrace that? The second person I want to talk about is Elred of Rivo, and he embraces that kind of imperfection or incompleteness as he writes about the limitations of friendship until its fulfillment in Christ. Elred was a Cistercian abbot in the 12th century, and a combination of accounts of his relationships prior to monastic life and his intense commitment to close male friendships within the monastic community have given rise to speculation that he was queer. Elred wrote extensively on friendship, and these close male friendships were evidently really important to him. Now, I wouldn't personally argue that they were actually homosexual relationships, because I don't think that does justice to his monastic vows, but I would absolutely describe his friendships as queer because of their intensity and because they were specifically male-orientated. Because of how highly Elred values friendship, he puts limitations or boundaries on it, which can sound kind of harsh and judgmental at first, but which I think are more realistic for us messy and imperfect humans. He argues that love your enemy doesn't mean attempting to be friends with everyone you don't like. He distinguishes between friendship, which is intentional, considered, selective love for a few, and the universal love for all God's people, which doesn't require agreement, trust, or closeness. This almost feels like a cop-out, but I think it's actually harder to aim towards a more realistic goal, developing good, healthy relationships and communities which point towards God, than it is to aim towards an impossible goal, loving everyone as fully as God loves them. Elred doesn't try to befriend the entire world. Instead, he focuses on nurturing good friendships, which offer limited glimpses of God's love, which then can draw us onwards to the wider love of neighbour, creating this kind of circle between imperfect human love and God's love, which brings us closer and closer towards fulfilment in God. As he writes in his book Spiritual Friendship, this friendship, to which here we admit but few, will be outpoured upon all, and by all outpoured upon God, and God shall be all in all. Marinos experienced the pain of living with imperfect community. Elred finds ways to thrive within the incompleteness of community. And I think that Elred's understanding of friendship is helpful in navigating conflict in communities, particularly because of his realism in setting limitations. Society is increasingly interconnected, and this enables loads of great things. But when our communities can be bigger, so can our conflicts. And when our communities are bigger, they're often less connected and less tightly woven, and so our conflicts have less relationality to ground them in. Elred shows us the value in focusing on the smaller scale, where relationships can be more personal and robust, where conflicts can be rehumanized, where we can eventually run out of things to argue about and, like Marinos, get on with the ordinary task of everyday holiness. By letting go of that impossible ideal of building community with all people, we can get on with building God's kingdom in our incomplete little communities on a scale that fits our little human selves. Small communities are still capable of causing harm and of fighting and of disagreeing, but I think they offer a different way through the dehumanized and therefore polarized conflicts that seem inevitable in those bigger contexts. Elred reminds us that small good things are part of God's vastness. And that focus on the small things brings us back to that sense of marginality common to both queerness and monasticism. Queer monasticism isn't about being in the center of things or in the crowded places. Marginal communities are small, and they're often more close-knit and resilient because of it. God who is in the margins is a God who is in the small, everyday things, in the little glimpses of holiness, in the small conflicts that can be navigated. And all of these things are the little parts that we can play in the community of God's kingdom. And so my question for you to take away and reflect on is, how might those insights of queer monasticism, getting on with everyday holiness, finding God in the small things, approaching conflict on a smaller and more human scale, help to strengthen the communities that you're part of?
Thank you, Jen. We're now passing on to our penultimate speaker, Moll, who will be talking autism and doubt. What if Thomas wasn't a faithless disciple?
Hi. Yes, please break the ice. I wonder if you have a character from the Gospels that you recognise yourself in the most. Maybe you feel an affinity with Paul with his dramatic moment of coming to know Christ. Your busyness might pull you to feeling like Martha with her pots and pans just trying to serve God in the best way she knew. My shorter friends might be considering finding their inner Zacchaeus to see the main stage later today, but I'm sure Greenbelt would not endorse that. Personally, I've always had a great sense of protection towards Thomas whenever this doubting disciple is brought up. Doubt is a state of mind I'm intimately aware of and one that I used to fear, which wasn't great because the way I explore faith appears to seem a lot like doubting to many of my peers and church leaders, the ones without autism and OCD. My brain doesn't work like theirs. My questioning, uncertainty, and refusal to accept and do what I was told has not always been received well. But I know God, I know Jesus, and most importantly, they know me better than I know myself. They understand how my chaotic, curious brain works, and I do think that seeing the story of Thomas through an autistic lens can provide valuable insight for the church to know God more deeply. We're going to do a mini Bible study, so everybody turn to John chapter 20. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus said to Thomas, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hands, reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." There are so many examples of Jesus' touch being so powerful. It heals, it raises from the dead, it comforts unimaginable distress. It is an honor to be able to touch Jesus. People fought through crowds at a chance of grasping at the hem of his cloaks. Here, Jesus is the one who invites Thomas to touch his wounds. This is not a reprimand to prove to Thomas how weak he was, but a privilege afforded to someone that Jesus loves. Sometimes people try to excuse Thomas by saying that he wasn't doubting, but what does it matter if he was? It's a pretty reasonable reaction to what happened in the past week, I reckon. And yet, Jesus doesn't stop him from coming to believe. He knows what Thomas needs and offers that to him because his love for Thomas and the results of his actions on the cross are not dependent on Thomas understanding or even accepting them. When I doubt and question, that doesn't and cannot stop God's love for me. What matters to Jesus is not how we come to believe in his love, but that we know it intimately and whatever way means we recognize it. If Thomas's doubt helped God to be revealed to him in a tangible way, then how might God reveal themselves to us if we stopped being so scared of our doubts and allowed ourselves to explore and question? There's a certain amount of bravery from Thomas in this passage as well. He's admitting that he cannot yet believe in this saviour that his peers are pinning all of their hope on. Thomas could have just kept quiet, preventing the awkward questions from the other disciples, stopping the inevitable quoting of scripture about the Messiah, distancing himself from the shame that he is simply not good enough. But he didn't. He didn't do what many of us and what I have done when church teachings make no sense. Thomas is not saying, "This is impossible, I will not believe." He is saying, "This is important. I want to believe, and here is what I need to do so." Thomas recognizes the true depths of who Jesus is, and that's shown through the powerful acclamation of "My God." Thomas is the first to announce this post-resurrection, the first to recognize who this man is, that he didn't survive death through some trick or magic workaround, but that he died, was buried, and rose again. Look at what happens when adjustments are made to enable all to join in with the building of faith. Those of us with autistic brains are often told that we don't see the world in the same way as neurotypicals, and that is often implied to be a bad thing, that we are too black and white, that we don't understand flexibility, that you have no concept of nuance. Here we see an example of someone who looks at the same situation that others have already had plenty of time to think about, processing it differently, and seeing a new perspective. As autistic people, we have learned that our brains are different, and in order to survive in the world, we will hide this until we are so overpowered by emotion that we cannot do that any longer. I love recognizing myself in Thomas here. In the times where I have known God so intimately and truly that I cannot contain myself from proclaiming "My God." A couple of years ago, I was introduced to Nadia Boltz-Weber's Beatitudes by a chaplain at my university who is sat in the corner. A favorite at Greenbelt. Nadia expresses her views that the Beatitudes are not a list of qualities that we are expected to have to receive Jesus' blessings, but that this passage was just an example of Jesus looking at who was around him on that day and in that particular space and blessing them. This version of Jesus, one that cannot contain his love for each and every one of us and wants all to know how blessed they are, seems closer to the truth of Jesus than one who rebukes Thomas and makes a pretty snide comment to him about his lack of faith. Jesus has already blessed Thomas in this passage by inviting him to touch his wounds. Jesus' desire to not leave anyone out of blessings then results in him speaking aloud a blessing to those of us who haven't seen. I don't read judgment into this comment, I don't see Jesus saying, "You have failed. Only those who blindly trust me are worthy of my love." I actually see Jesus acknowledging that for those of us who do not get to reach out and touch his side, believing in the resurrection will be hard, and yet have come to believe. It is something we will come to believe after overcoming that hurdle. Jesus is not condemning Thomas for doing what he needed to help him believe. He's expressing his love for all of us who come to believe in whatever way we do. I know I've hyped doubt up a little bit in this, but I want to add the caveat that as someone with OCD, aka the doubting disorder, I know that doubt is not always a good thing for our brains. Doubt can paralyze me, nothing ever being good enough to satisfy the fears that my mind creates for me. However, as I begin to learn to respect my doubts, I can recognize whether these doubts come from a place of fear that needs comforting or curiosity that needs understanding. And through this, I experience a richer faith. Trusting that we don't need all of the answers, but that God is with us in our searching and in our decision to stop looking, can lead us to discussions and realizations we didn't know were there. Embracing a diverse range of brains, ones that come from different angles, that see stories in different lights, that understand facts differently, that feel the presence of God differently, can only enhance our relationship with God. My autistic brain was given to me by God. God gave me this curiosity. God gave me this desire to know. God gave me this way of seeing the world. What could be on the other side of your doubt? God delights in us reaching out to their scars and asking to touch. So how could Jesus reveal himself to you if you stopped trying to figure it all out by yourself? And like Thomas, just told him what you need. Thank you.
Thank you, Mel. We are now on to our final talk of this afternoon. It's Ruben who will be talking art, Christ, and ecology. Please welcome Ruben.
Ecological theologies seek to explore and understand a proper Christian response to the natural world, and crucially today, to the climate crisis. And eco-theology has done a really good job of focusing on creation and on stewardship and on dominion. But the Christological issues of incarnation and of resurrection, and then connectedly of salvation, have not been wrestled with in an ecological key to the extent that I think they should be. And I would argue that the doctrine of Christology, which is the study of the person and the nature of Christ, has been neglected and marginalized within eco-theology. And this becomes especially apparent when you compare the richness and thoroughness of other contextual Christologies, like queer Christologies, feminist Christologies, and black Christologies, with the near non-existence of an ecological Christology. We don't hear about the eco-Christ. And my diagnosis of the problem is that the inherent and legitimate anthropocentrism of Christology has made it really hard for theologians to articulate an ecological Christology. So anthropocentrism in the Christian tradition refers to the centering of humankind over and above non-human creation, and subsequently the view that God's concern for humankind exceeds God's concern for the rest of creation. And the task of de-anthropocentrizing Christianity and Christology is one of resisting a strong anthropocentrism, which falsely asserts the exclusive importance of human beings before God and extends the economy of salvation only so far as humankind. So the primary task of an ecological Christology is to challenge this strong anthropocentrism, which is inherent in traditional understandings of Christology, of the incarnation of Christ and of ourselves as human beings. However, an ecological Christology must retain and cannot dilute the special meaning of the incarnation for humankind. And therefore, we need to retain a weak form of anthropocentrism in order to do justice to the doctrine of the work of Christ. Because I don't think we will get very far if we deny that for human beings, the incarnation of Christ is good news in a very special and slightly different way to the way that he is also good news for creation more broadly. So one 21st century theological doctrine, which has ecological potential, is the doctrine of deep incarnation. And this was first proposed by Niels Gregersen in 2001 and has been variously developed over the past 20 years and in the last five or so years has taken a more ecological turn. And the theology of deep incarnation focuses on the declaration of John 1:14, that the Word became flesh. So why does John write that the Word became flesh? Why does John not say the Word became human? Because the Word did become human, but the Word became flesh. So maybe we can expand the category of incarnation to mean more than just incarnation into humankind, but understand a deeper incarnation into the fabric or the flesh of the cosmos, of which all of creation is a part. And deep incarnation has ecological potential because it advances this vision of all of creation being taken up in the transformative promise that we have as a result of the incarnation of Christ. And with deep incarnation, creation is transformed from being merely this backdrop above which the divine and human drama plays out, into being directly impacted and thought of explicitly as directly impacted by the consequences of the incarnation. And the inclusive and ecological perspective offered by theologies of deep incarnation seek to extend the promise of transformation to the natural world, beyond merely the human, but it also importantly retains a mysterious character. We don't know exactly what this transformation will look like, and if we try to do that and construct an overdetermined eschatology and try to lay out exactly what the transformation of the world and all of creation looks like, we risk neglecting our present and natural world, because we will end up seeing it as disposable, because the new world is coming and we will not pay proper attention and care to the world we have now. So the character of mystery is absolutely crucial in reminding us that while something else is coming, we don't know exactly what that is, and we have to take action and care now. So deep incarnation does, I think, offer us strong paths for constructing an ecological Christology. Because with deep incarnation, the incarnation of Christ has a dual purpose. The first is that God became flesh to reconcile human beings, crucially, who sin, with God. But secondly, that God became flesh for the purpose of conjoining God and creation together so intensely that a material world, our material world, which is characterized by decomposition and frailty and by suffering, also has a future and a promise of transformation. And therefore we can maintain the important Christological understanding that human beings possess unique faculties whilst avoiding an incarnational theology which doesn't have the proper ecological importance. And it's really important that these things are taken together and that the natural world is not an afterthought in our incarnational theology and in our Christology. But one limit of deep incarnation is that at the moment it remains very much within the university and within the academic study of theology. I had not heard of it outside of the university. And it also remains within the verbal theological tradition. And therefore, I don't think it can affect a revolution in our Christian worldview and in our Christology and in our incarnational theologies more broadly, because it's not accessible to corporate Christianity more widely. So this leads me to ask, what other resources or formats we might be able to use to approach what we might call the eco-Christ. So what is clear is that the urgency of the ecological crisis requires that we turn to new resources and consider previously underutilized resources when constructing an eco-theology. And it's really important to stress that in using new resources, we're not doing that in a spirit of apocalypticism or a spirit of desperation, because that doesn't do justice to their legitimacy and the truthfulness that they might contain if we treat them as a last-ditch attempt to restore our theology to something that might be able to protect the natural world in a time of crisis. So a successful ecological theology will require a revolution in our anthropocentric perspective. And I believe that the visual arts can be an accessible tool for shifting perspectives and for de-anthropocentrizing our worldview. And this turn to the visual arts is stimulated firstly by Karl Rahner's assertion that theology cannot be complete until it appropriates the arts as an intrinsic moment of theology itself. And secondly, John W. de Gruyter writes that art in the life of the church can provide an alternative vision which helps us to perceive reality in a new way. And with both deep incarnation and the visual arts, this renewed perception opens up possibilities of transformation. And de Gruyter argues that the lack of representations of nature in churches might explain why Christians often fail to recognize the connection between their faith and the environment. And art in churches is often Christological, but it's quite rarely ecological. And these are broad strokes, but they are broadly true. Yet, when it comes to art in churches, stained glass art can achieve a synthesis between form and content, and between Christology and ecology, if its images are grounded in nature. Because stained glass is both highly recyclable and crucially relies on the natural world. It relies on sunlight to be seen in its full glory. And there's a fantastic stained glass window by the English artist John Piper, which is in Robinson College Chapel in Cambridge. And the window is blue and green and yellow, and it's essentially an image of a bright light. It's like a sun filtering through green foliage. And it's called Light of the World, which of course refers to Christ. So this image, this piece of artwork, reinforces the image of Christ's proximity to nature and the suggestion that Christ will mysteriously transform all of nature through the incarnation, which is the light of the world. But it also retains that special importance of the incarnation for humankind, because the window is designed so that you are bathed in its light most thoroughly whilst kneeling at the altar. So in that moment when you are kneeling at the altar and encountering the flesh of Christ in the Eucharist and receiving the first fruits of bodily transformation, that is the moment when that window can be seen at its most fantastic. And the naturalistic imagery rejects anthropocentrism whilst preserving space for Christ's unique purpose for humankind. And imagine if we could all, every week, or indeed every day, encounter Christ in the Eucharist in this profoundly ecological context, which celebrates the natural world. And perhaps we may all have a taste of this tomorrow. And this is one example of how art in the sanctuary can speak to the transformation of all life. So by way of conclusion, we have the problem of anthropocentrism in Christology, because Christ does have special importance for human beings. And the doctrine of deep incarnation allows us to explore more broadly, through the idea of incarnation into flesh, what transformation might mean for all of creation without diminishing this special human importance. And the visual arts might breach this gap between deep incarnation and our apprehension of Jesus. It can allow us to literally see Christ in new ways, but also to experience transformation when taking the Eucharist alongside the natural world and alongside images of nature. And maybe these are some of the resources which might begin to enact a revolution in our anthropocentric worldview and which will lead us to a more ecological Christology. And my question for you is quite a simple one. It is, how has or how does art enable you to see Christ in new ways? Thank you.
Thank you, Ruben. That was the final of our speakers. So if you'd like to join with me in showing your appreciation for all the young speakers from this afternoon.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.